Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
It became really clear that what had happened to me was absolutely a miracle. They did all kinds of tests on me. The doctor who had been treating me before my collapse and had shown me that my liver enzymes were 209, she ran full blood work on me and showed me the new blood work saying, Joe, you're perfectly normal. Your liver is normal.
Yeah.
And I basically looked her right in the eye because people had been using that word miracle about me. And I said, is what happened to me a miracle? She said, absolutely. There's no explanation, Joe. It doesn't exist.
Lifelong alcoholic Joe McGivney drank himself into brain damage and permanent disability. But the day after being placed into the assisted care he would need for the rest of his life, he suddenly sprang back to full recovery and restored health. It was a medical impossibility, and it's something he credits the intercession of Blessed Father Michael McGivney, his distant relative, who's also the founder of the Knights of Columbus in the 19th century, and who's now being considered for canonization on the basis of recorded intercessory miracles like the one that Joe experienced 2 years ago. So Joe's testimony, now a book, You're a Miracle, is the topic of our conversation today on Almost Good Catholics. Welcome to Almost Good Catholics, a conversation about theology and apologetics. I'm your host, Chris Odinietz, and I get to ask interesting people the interesting questions. And they share their conclusions, explaining what we know, how we know it, why we think we know it. I hope this dialogue may help us approach the truth and have a really great time doing it. If you'd like to join the conversation, please email almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to Joe McGivney. After doing serious brain damage to himself, he wrote the book, You're a Miracle, which are the words that he heard from a psychiatrist he met at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting 2 years ago. What he'd heard earlier from his doctors that there was no medical explanation for his recovery was echoed by this total stranger. He had suffered from Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, a deficiency of thiamine vitamin B1, which affects memory, sense of reality, walking, and seeing. It happens to some people who suffer from extreme cases of alcoholism, sometimes because of malnutrition, for example, to British soldiers who were Japanese prisoners of war in Singapore in the 1940s. No one recovers. Some people die. Some people live with debilitating brain damage their whole lives in assisted care. But after drinking his whole life and doubling down on the pattern during COVID, Joe McGivney developed this condition and lost his mind for 9 weeks. Then, overnight, he got it back, with all systems back to normal, including liver enzymes that went from 209, the highest his doctor had ever seen, back down to 18, which is perfectly normal. But he had a lot of people praying for him, including for the intercession of a sainted man with the same last name as he, Father Michael McGivney, founder of the Knights of Columbus, the largest Catholic fraternal organization in the world, founded in 1882 in Connecticut, a mutual aid organization for poor immigrants, such as the Irish-American community that Father McGivney had served and indeed was a member of himself. The story is a tremendous miracle, and unlike many miracles which happened in the Middle Ages, this one happened a couple of years ago. And the man I'm talking today is a living, breathing, walking Lazarus for the 21st century. So what a pleasure and honor to have you as our guest on Almost Good Catholics.
Thank you for that beautiful introduction, Chris. Wow, humbled.
Well, thanks be to God. Thanks be to God. Do you have any jokes to share with our people to get us started?
Okay, I'll go with a very appropriate, really funny, but yet really silly dad joke. How come the teddy bear wouldn't eat his dinner?
I don't know.
Because he was stuffed.
You're a dad, I'm a dad, I'm going to use that. And tell us your story.
Well, I guess might make sense to start at the beginning. I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago in a predominantly Irish Catholic neighborhood. I was the typical cradle Catholic. I think I was baptized within 10 days of my birth, made all the sacraments, and was raised in a beautiful, loving, supportive family environment. Both my mother and father were, you know, good practicing Catholics at the time. And again, they could not have been more loving and supportive of me in my childhood. It was kind of like a Norman Rockwell painting. So, you know, during my youth, you know, as I was going to church and, you know, participating in the sacraments when I was young, when I look back, probably because of my own selfishness or just lack of interest, I really never connected with the church. I knew the prayers and I went to church on Sunday, but I really never felt that, you know, relationship with God or that connection to the church. After elementary school, I went to an all-boys Catholic high school called Brother Rice High School in Chicago that was taught by the Irish Christian Brothers. And one would have thought that would have built an even stronger Catholic foundation for me, but it just didn't. And then once I went off to college, I attended the University of Illinois in Champaign, Urbana, a very large university, Big Ten school. And I no longer had to go to church, so I just stopped. And that really followed me through my adulthood. I could probably count on two hands the number of times I walked into a church after leaving Brother Rice High School up until just a couple years ago. And like the only time I went to Mass was if it was a funeral or a wedding.
Yeah. Can I ask you, do you have a sense of why that happens? I remember being very much just like you as a teenager. My parents would take me to, we're Polish immigrants. They would take me to church every Sunday. And I would just flip to the back of the book and memorize Battle Hymn of the Republic for an hour. Or I would do exercises where I was holding my breath and see if I could beat my record. Because I was like, why am I going back to Mass? I already know how it ends. I know how it went last week. I know how it's going to go next week. Is it just because we have everything we already need? So we have we're so self-sufficient that we don't, we're just down here. Why does that happen to teenage boys?
You know, I think it's a great point. It's not only self-sufficient, but for me, self-absorbed. I didn't see what was in it for me. You know, what was the church doing for me? I didn't see he was doing anything for me. So what was, you know, what was the point? I was viewing the world even back then in my youth as through this very selfish lens. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the early formation or the faith formation that I had or lack thereof on my part. But also during my youth, that's where my love affair with alcohol began. Growing up, I was actually a really good student. I was a pretty solid, good athlete. I wouldn't say I was one of the cool kids, but I also wasn't, you know, completely socially awkward, you know, mm-hmm. But I always had this feeling that I didn't belong. It was like I was on the outside looking in. I wasn't cool enough. I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't good enough as an athlete. You know, when it came to the girls, you know, they weren't paying that much attention to me. And I just felt like I didn't belong anywhere. That all changed on a warm summer night in Chicago, just before I entered the eighth grade. There were six of us guys hanging out in one of my buddies' front yards, and his brother came walking out of the house, and someone asked, "Hey, where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to the liquor store." And one of us chimed in and said, "Will you get some beer for us?" And he said, "If you give me the money, I will." And we reached into our pockets, put some money together, and he came back with 3 6 packs of old style beer, which, by the way, is the most awful beer ever. But it was really cheap. It's a Chicago thing.
Yeah.
So there were three beers for each of us, each of the six of us. And I remember popping the top and nearly vomiting as I was trying to get that first beer down. But I also noticed that I started to feel different. And by the time I got to that third beer, I felt really, really good. It was as though all of my fears, my self-doubt, just drifted away. Suddenly I was now funny, and I was charming, and I was confident, and I loved that feeling. I also remember very well the following morning when I woke up my first hangover. You know, my parents, I was able to sneak past my parents when I came home that night. You know, they didn't know that I had been drinking. You know, I went to my room, closed the door, woke up the next morning feeling awful. And I think for a normal person, they would have then said, "I'm never doing that again." I was the opposite. I couldn't wait to do it again. And starting then, I became a weekend warrior. I was drinking along with my friends virtually every weekend through high school. And then in the later part of my high school career, during my junior and senior year, I also started randomly drinking during the week as well with a small group of friends of ours. You know, we'd come home after school to somebody's house where the parents weren't home yet, and we'd raid the liquor cabinet for no other reason other than that it just felt good. So then from there,
that's such a young age. That's such a young age that they just fly under the radar the whole time. Because if you're going to eighth grade, you're, you know, 12 or 13, you're still in your parents' supervision for a whole nother 4 years. I think that happens to a lot of us in college. Certainly I was doing shenanigans in college when we suddenly have all this freedom. But how did this happen as a teenager in high school?
You know, where I grew up, it was I would say it was culturally accepted and acceptable. You know, being good Irish Catholics, we celebrated everything, you know, from baptisms to funerals and everything in between, any excuse to have a party, and a celebration, and alcohol always played a pivotal role in all those celebrations. Thankfully, my parents were not alcoholics. Not even close. They drank, but very socially and occasionally. But when you look at my father's side of my family tree, alcoholism was everywhere. In fact, you know, in my own, with me and my two sisters, I was the oldest of three. Even though my parents were not alcoholics, certainly I was. And my middle sister, Erin, her alcoholism and prescribed drug abuse took her life. So two of the three of my mom and dad's kids certainly suffered from the disease of alcoholism. And when I look at, again, the other parts of my family tree, it's common, very common.
Gotcha.
And again, just culturally, in the neighborhood we grew up with, I remember being literally, again, in eighth grade, and one of my friend's parents would buy alcohol for us.
Wow.
But we had a rule that we had to spend the night at their house, And, you know, we were too young to even drive. We didn't even have car keys. But they in their rationalization was, you know, they knew we were going to be out drinking. So it was like, if they were going to do that, we'd rather you all drink under our supervision than running the streets.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So that was just kind of how it was on the south side of Chicago back in those days.
Yeah, and then this is the 1970s, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I graduated high school in 1981. So yeah, that would have been the late 1970s.
So then what happens?
So I, you know, was kind of off to the races with my alcoholism. I left University of Illinois and went to work in the investment industry. My father had a small investment firm, and I now found myself elbow to elbow with adults that were, you know, had mortgages and children. I was a young, you know, 20-something kid, basically. And I immediately found my people of that group, you know, the group of working adults. Many of them, after a hard day's work, went home to their families and to their kids' athletic events and all that. But there was also another group that went right to the bar. And I joined that group. And I felt like I fit in again. So after that, during my late 20s, early 30s, I was living in downtown Chicago as a single guy. And there was Chicago is a fun place to live when you're a young single person. And there was I drink I was now drinking every single day. Not to say that it was blackout drunk every day, because I wasn't. I don't know if I can remember a day where I did not have at least one beer or one glass of vodka, truthfully. Ultimately ended up meeting my first wife, having my two wonderful children, incredible children, Allie and Colin, who are now young adults. But of course, as a result of my alcoholism, that first marriage, you know, I burned it down. Fortunately, I was able to, you know, share custody, and the children, my kids, Allie and Colin, spent half the time with me and half the time with their mother. Soon after that first divorce, though, I then met the love of my life, my beautiful angel, Nicole. And we ultimately became married. Not only was she just an amazing woman, an amazing wife, but she was an amazing stepfather for my children.
Stepmother.
I'm sorry, stepmother. But unfortunately, you know, I was still an alcoholic. And over a period of a few years, my drinking continued and my alcoholism continued to progress like it usually does. And I started now on weekends overdoing it often, to the point where I was becoming a blackout drunk on the weekends. And I remember countless mornings on a Saturday morning where I'd wake up after a Friday night of drinking. Not sure what even Nicole and I had talked about that night, prior night. Not sure of whether or not I was kind and nice to her as I should have been, because there's sometimes in those blackout moments, I wasn't, you know, easy to be around. I was, you know, short-tempered and just kind of a jerk, you know, physical abuse. But I was just, you know, I was an alcoholic. I was a drunk. Now, the other interesting part of that story too, though, is you know, from as far as my career goes, I was a highly functioning alcoholic. I had did very, very well financially. At my job at the, I had found a little niche in the investment world that I worked in, where my primary role was to deepen relationships and build relationships with some of our larger clients. And that often involved entertaining them, you know, playing golf, going to, you know, other sporting events, fancy dinners at wonderful steakhouses. And that was part of my role. And so I had kind of found my dream job. And anyway, so that continued to progress And Nicole, the love of my life, ultimately had had enough. And she left me. But by the grace of God, over a period of a few months, we came back together, started seeing a therapist. We were already divorced, but we went and started seeing a therapist. And we reached an agreement about my drinking. And it was that I would no longer be a blackout drunk, that I would now drink like a gentleman.
Yes.
And that worked.
Yes.
For a while.
Yes.
And then it worked until the beginning of COVID.
Yeah. At which point your kids are grown.
Yeah. At that point, my daughter is now in college. And my son was a junior, he would have been a junior in high school when COVID had kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my daughter, for example, was a COVID kid. She never had a high school graduation. She never had a prom. But she ultimately actually just graduated college.
Hey, congratulations.
Yeah. So anyway, so everything changed when COVID began. All of my fears, a lot of them about the financial stability of my family, just started spiraling. The firm I worked, like many people, the firm I worked for essentially closed, shut down. You know, my income had dropped to nearly zero. My wife, Nicole, was still going to school, still working. She's a kindergarten teacher
mm-hmm.
in a private school. So she was bringing in some income, but it was certainly not enough to cover the lifestyle that we had. I had to pay the mortgage and the car payments. And I've got one kid on the way to in college, one on the way. And my fears just overwhelmed me. And rather than turn to my family, my friends, my faith, or my church, I just turned to vodka.
Yeah.
And beginning in early March of 2020, I developed a medication ritual for myself, where at 7 a.m., Nicole would leave to go to school. And I would give her a little bit of a head start. I was out the door soon after, and I found a local liquor store about 20 minutes away that opened at 7 in the morning. And I was the first guy to walk into the store every day.
Yeah.
And I would buy the mini bottles like you get on airplanes, bottles of vodka. And I would literally drink those three in the parking lot at 7:15 or 7:20 in the morning. Now, why three? Well, I was very calculating. I knew that three shots of vodka would take me to 0.075 as far as my blood alcohol level, meaning legally I could drop. The reason I knew this is I had my own personal breathalyzer that I bought online where I could check myself throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that three shots took me to 0.075. And I also learned that it took 1 hour for my body to metabolize one shot. So 2 hours later, now 9 o'clock in the morning, I could do two more shots. So I did. Now, the local liquor store that was 5 minutes away was open. So I had done my three shots at 7 a.m. I would do two more at 9, two more at 11 a.m., two more at 1 p.m., two more at 3 p.m. 5 p.m., my wife comes home. We would go to the grocery store. It's COVID. There's not much going on. We'd get food, and I would sidetrack into the liquor store. And I no longer had to worry about driving for that day.
Mm-hmm.
So I would come out of that liquor store with three more shots of vodka and two bottles of wine to get me through the night. And I did that every single day from early March of 2020 until December 30th.
Right. And if you add them up, 3 + 2 + 2 + 2 + 2 + 3, that's a whole fifth of vodka. And what
It
are you
is.
doing in between? Are you on Zoom calls or answering emails? What are you doing for those 2 hours while you're waiting?
Sometimes there were Zoom calls.
Yeah.
My employer, again, my income went to zero, but they kind of improvised during COVID, and they were doing a lot of training and education for us and so on. But that did not take up a whole lot of time.
Yeah.
And I technically was not drunk.
Yeah.
So, but my brain was being soaked in vodka morning, noon, and night. It literally, when I would get up in the morning, I'd hit that breathalyzer the first thing I did to make sure I was back down to 0.0, and then I rushed to the liquor store.
Yeah.
So my body never rested, never got a break.
That's so. I've never heard of a case like this because you are so in control and so out of control simultaneously.
Right.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's the disease, it's the insanity of full-blown alcoholism.
Yeah.
So December 30th.
I think you're like the slave who is entrusted with the management of somebody's great estate because you're entirely enslaved, but you're so competent and so able to figure out how to walk that razor's edge.
That's a really good way to
Yeah.
put it, Chris.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. So December 30th of 2020 became the night that would forever alter the course of my life. Nicole and I had decided to beat the New Year's Eve rush. There were in down here in Florida, restaurants were now beginning to open at that point. And Nicole and I went out to dinner on December 30th rather than go out on New Year's Eve and fight the crowds and so on. And after dinner, which course involved more drinking for me, we went back to the house. And by the way, everything I'm going to talk about it right now, I have no memory of, no personal memory of.
Yeah, and in your book, this chapter is written by Nicole, right? It's from her first person perspective.
It is
Yeah.
indeed, yes. So all I know about that period, I learned from Nicole, and I also learned from the medical records of all the institutions that I had been in. We'll get to that. So December 30th, I collapse on the living room floor of our home. It's around 11 o'clock at night. Nicole had already gone upstairs, gone to sleep. I stayed downstairs drinking and watching, TV. And apparently, when I collapsed to the floor and was unable to even lift myself up or even get on my knees. And thankfully, I had my cell phone in my hand when I went down. And apparently, I called Nicole, and she, grace of God, had a ringer on her phone. She picked up, and I said to her, "Nicole, I need your help. Something's wrong." And she came downstairs to find me again on this, completely incapacitated on the floor, living room floor. And somehow she managed to get me to a hospital. She was afraid that maybe I was having a stroke because I couldn't even barely walk. I was making no sense. I was speaking in gibberish. And it races me to a hospital. It's COVID. So they meet her at the emergency room doors, put me in a wheelchair, and send her home. They're like, "You can't come in." So they admitted me to Jupiter Medical Center, a local hospital. Very quickly figured out that I was going through alcohol withdrawal. But withdrawal, they figured out a few days later. At first, they're trying to figure out whether I had a stroke. They ran all kinds of tests. And over the following few days in that first hospital, it was pretty touch and go for me. I nearly died. I was in the intensive care unit for a number of days. They got me stabilized. They got me detoxed from alcohol over a period of 7 to 10 days. But cognitively, I was getting worse. For most people, even a really hardcore alcoholic, once they get you physically detoxed safely in a medical environment, and then they send you home. But I was getting crazier each and every day. So over the next 9 weeks, I was in a number of institutions, three hospitals included, with my last stop being a locked psych ward at St. Mary's Hospital in West Palm Beach. And at that point, they had figured out what I had. And I had advanced Korsakoff psychosis, which is brought on, like you said, there's a thiamine deficiency, they believe, is what triggers this series of events. But there's a lot of medical research to still be done on that, because they can't figure out, you know, why some people that abuse alcohol progress all the way to that psychosis and others don't. And the thiamine part of it, they speculate might be play a role. And I've read a lot of the medical research on this, but there's still no explanation for, you know, out of 100 people that get that diagnosis, 80 of them never come back.
Mm-hmm.
20 of them die. I got past that hurdle. But that leaves the remaining 80 out of 100 that will all be have some kind of permanent disability, most of which will end up like I was, where you're just in your own little world, hallucinating. In my case, I was frequently restrained. I was violent. I was a danger to myself, they said, to the other patients. Long story short, Nicole was told, and my family was told, that, hey, he's going to be this way for the rest of his life. We're so sorry, but we can't hold him here anymore. We're going to send him home. And, you know, poor Nicole, who's 90 pounds soaking wet, you know, they're telling her, your violent, hallucinating, crazy husband's going to go home with you soon. So you got to figure out that plan,
yes.
Which, of course, taking me home for her was not an option.
Yeah.
So they basically said, you know, you need to find a forever home for him, because can't stay here. By the grace of God, Nicole found a treatment facility here locally that agreed to hold me for 30 days, essentially to buy her time. And Nicole was also working very closely with one of my relatives, my Aunt Jerry. She's a McGivney. She's my father's sister. And Aunt Jerry's a very skilled nurse and was talking to the doctors and, you know, relaying in English what all the doctors were saying. And she was relaying those messages to my family, including Nicole. So Aunt Jerry and Nicole are scrambling, both doing research to find a permanent home for me. Nicole finds that local treatment facility that says, we'll hold them for 30 days. Not 31, 30.
Mm-hmm.
You got to figure this out. They checked me. They transported me from the locked psych ward directly into that treatment facility. They put me to bed. And I woke up the following morning completely healed with medical, cognitive, physical deficits of any kind.
Right.
I was fully healed.
Which is physically impossible.
Physically impossible.
Yeah.
No medical explanation.
Yeah.
So long story short, so I'm in this treatment facility. I'm now awake. I have no idea how I had gotten there, where I was. You know, they filled in all those blanks for me. And I now had a goal. Show you how powerful this alcoholism can be. I still was not convinced that I had a drinking problem. And my only goal at that point is, okay, I got to be here. I learned for 30 days. I said, I need to get out way before 30 days, because I need to get to Nicole as fast as I can to mm-hmm. convince her to stay with me. And I was, that was my mission, was not get sober. My mission was not give up alcohol. My mission was get the hell out of there so I could get to Nicole. So long story short, about a week and a half in, it's COVID again. So Nicole can't come see me, but my therapist sets up a conference call with Nicole, my therapist, and me. So I'm sitting in the therapist's office. He calls Nicole. She's on speakerphone. And he says, you know, the minute she picked up the phone, I could tell in her voice that this conversation was not going to go well. And after a little small talk, Nicole said, Joe, she's now crying. And she said, Joe, you really don't understand. I have any idea what you really have been through, do you? And I said, truthfully, I don't. You know, I can't wrap my head around it. She said, well, I am so, so happy that you're doing well, but I can't do this anymore. And when you get home, I've already packed up. I've already contacted a lawyer. We're getting a divorce. She said, when you get out of there, talk to your Aunt Jerry. She'll fill in all the blanks for you, but I'm done. I can't do this anymore. The therapist tries to interrupt the call and says, Nicole, wait, you know, let's hit the pause button here. You don't need to make these decisions today. Why don't we schedule another call? And Nicole interrupts him and says, there will be no other call, and hangs up the phone.
Yeah.
And so in that moment, I felt more broken than I had ever felt in my life. I'm literally crying in this therapist's office. I felt like someone had beaten me with a baseball bat or run over me with a truck. And he looks me in the eye and he says, Joe, I'm so sorry, but this, you need to go to an AA meeting, and there's one starting in 5 minutes. And I had some words for him, words I won't repeat on a nice couch. And somehow he convinced, AA meetings were not required for us to attend.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he convinced me to go. And it would have been 6:30 p.m. on a Monday, Wednesday, or Friday night, because those are the nights they did AA meeting. And in that first meeting of AA, I had never been to an AA meeting before. I didn't know what to expect. So I'm in this room with about 50 people sitting at tables, and they read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous at the beginning. And step number 3 says, we made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. And I was like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like a little whisper in my head saying, pay attention now. And I was laser focused on that. I said, wait a minute, I made a decision to turn my life and my will over to God. I know God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Catholic. If that's the key, I need to figure that out, how to do that. Then after this brief moment of hope, I'm now feeling a sense of dread, because what would God want to do with me? If the key to this program of recovery lies in turning my will and life over to God, now I'm a little terrified that God's going to want no part of it for me. Because I had walked away from my church, from my faith years and years ago. I, you know, frankly, was not a good human being. You know, I was an alcoholic. I was selfish and flawed. And anyway, so after they read the steps, like most AA meetings, there was a speaker. This man got up and told his story. And his story sounded exactly like mine.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow. And he shared at the end of how he had not only, you know, put his life back together again, but by working through the steps and figuring out how to surrender everything to God, he was living a life that was filled now with joy and peace and serenity and happiness. He had gotten his family back. He was, you know, you could see it on his face. This guy was someone I wanted to be like. And that's when I went all in. So I used my time in the treatment facility. But on the way out, a pivotal moment in my life, they're doing discharge paperwork on me. And this woman who's doing it says, Joe, what's your plan from here? You're going home. What are you going to tell me what you're going to do? And I flippantly looked at her and said, don't worry, I got it. She chuckles like you just did. And she said, Joe, you don't got this. You know, God may have healed you physically, but you're still an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
She said, when you need a plan, she said, and I can tell you're not going to really want to hear what I have to say anyway, but I'm going to ask you to promise yourself two things. She challenged. She said, when you get out of here within 24 hours, you need to find an AA meeting and start looking for a sponsor. It's like, she's like within 24 hours, Joe, now this is critically important. And I said, okay, I can do that. And then the other thing she did, she Googled surrender prayer in all caps. And she showed it to me. And she, I don't know, this again, grace of God moment. She found this very long Catholic prayer that's just, you know, black type on a white background. And that day when I searched, you know, got home, I Googled surrender prayer in all caps, like she asked, and it showed up at the top of the results list. Most days when I check it nowadays, it's four or five down. But that day, it was right at the top.
Yeah.
And I printed it. And I started praying it every day. So after that first day, I got to an AA meeting. I found a sponsor, a man who I had done some business with a number of years ago, had somewhere along the line mentioned to me that he was in recovery. He was the only one person I knew that ever admitted that. So I called him. And he took me to my first meeting out in the real world. And started working the steps. And, you know, through the beauty of working through the steps of AA, my life just began to transform, change. And my cravings, my obsession, my compulsion to drink went away. God lifted that. And for the first time in my life, I was developing a relationship with God.
Mm.
And through that, you know, in telling my story to others and to seeing the doctors that were now treating me, it became really clear that what had happened to me was absolutely a miracle. They did all kinds of tests on me. The doctor who had been treating me before my collapse and had shown me that my liver enzymes were 209. She ran full blood work on me and showed me the new blood work saying, Joe, you're perfectly normal. Your liver is normal.
Yeah.
And I basically looked her right in the eye because people had been using that word miracle about me. And I said, is what happened to me a miracle? She said, absolutely. There's no explanation, Joe. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So I'm going, working my way through the program of AA, part of which is we should make a commitment to serve others, put others before ourselves. And I said, wait, And by the way, I'd started going back to church. I was every Sunday. And I said, I know how I can give back. Why don't I join the Knights of Columbus? After all, my relative is the founder. And so I learned that there was a Knights of Columbus council affiliated with the church I was going to, and I joined the Knights. So a few days after I joined, I had a phone call with my Aunt Jerry. She and I had started this tradition, this ritual of a Saturday morning phone call.
Mm-hmm.
When we started that right after I got out of treatment. And it was her way of checking in on me, providing support, checking in on me, encouragement, checking in on me. And in that call right after I joined the Knights, I told her, I said, Jerry, I joined the Knights of Columbus. And she starts crying.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no. What I do now? She says, Joey, I've never told you this, but when you were sick, I was praying to anyone who would listen. I was praying to Jesus. I was praying to God. I was praying to Mary, praying to our relatives. But I was fervently praying to Blessed Michael. And I'm looking at his picture right now.
Mm-hmm.
In that moment for me, up until then, I knew I was a miracle, but I, in the back of my mind, often struggled with why. Why did God save me? I certainly wasn't the only struggling alcoholic in the world. I certainly wasn't the only person with Korsakoff psychosis in the world. I certainly wasn't a good Catholic. I was a sinner with a capital S. Why did he choose to save me? And came to believe that Jerry's prayers to Father Michael resulted, we believe, in Father Michael interceding for me. And that's how I stand here today.
A lot of people, a lot of, you know, innocent people die all the time in car accidents or whatever, all the time. And we often, I think we think, oh, how could a just God let good things happen? I mean, bad things happen to good people. Well, from the Catholic point of view, this whole world is just a very short experience on our way back home. But at the same time, God is so interested in relationship with us and communication with us that he was able to use you, such an imperfect and broken tool, to reach all of us down here through this great saint. At the moment, he's blessed, but there's a number of miracles. There's a number of there's a canonization process that you can read about at the website that I'll link to below. There was one in 2015 about a family who had a child, and you write about it in your book. On page 62.
Yeah, little Mikey Shackle.
Yes, thank you, little Mikey Shackle. His father was a Knight of Columbus and well acquainted with Father McGivney's legacy, right? And he and his wife prayed specifically for Father McGivney to intercede for their baby in heaven, because that kid had a 0% chance of survival because of something called fetal high drops. But then a follow-up ultrasound revealed no trace of fetal high drops, and the baby boy is a joyful member of their family to this day. So that's, you know, for a tiny baby, such a dramatic miracle. And then now you, for a fully grown man, another miracle like this. It's such a mystery, you know, why this and not that, why here and not there.
It is indeed a mystery. And the I've obviously played this through countless times in my head. Maybe part of why I was was healed was God knew I would not keep the secret.
Yeah.
And God knew that I would share this beautiful story about it's really my and Nicole's experience from start to finish. This book and this story is God's. Mm-hmm. We're just his humble instruments. And, the other kind of interesting thing. So when you go back to Blessed Michael, he was canonized on October 31st of 2020. So just about 2 months, almost to the day.
Beatified. So
beatified, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. Almost 2 months to the day before I went down. My great-grandfather and Father Michael are believed to be second cousins. So my great-grandfather immigrated from Ireland and ended up in Chicago. Father Michael's parents immigrated from Ireland, ended up in Waterbury, Connecticut, where Father Michael was born and where he founded the Knights of Columbus. My grandfather on my father's side, Andrew McGivney, not only was a devout Catholic, he was a prominent figure in the Archdiocese of Chicago. He was an attorney, and he did a lot of pro bono legal work for the diocese. And he was also, back then in the Chicago Diocese, they had a monthly publication that was delivered to every parish, kind of like a bulletin. They would deliver stacks of this thing once a month. The publication was called The New World, and he was the lay editor of that magazine. So uber Catholic. So I have this in my own imagination, this meeting up in heaven, where my grandfather, Andrew, who's a knight and a devout Catholic, along with some of my other relatives, seeks out Blessed Michael It says, Father, one of our own needs your help really right now. Who knows? It's something we like to think about, or at least I do, is that, and one other thing too, the why me, why me? When Father Michael received his first parish assignment at St. Mary's Church in New Haven, Connecticut, which is where the Knights were founded, one of his very first ministries was to create a temperance society, the struggling alcoholic families that he saw in his parish.
Yeah, so if you have to go back to the 19th century, this is a time when Irish immigrants to the United States were the poorest of the poor, looked down upon by the WASPy Americans who had been here longer, and they're, you know, they're Catholics, they're foreign, Irish need not apply, sort of a thing. And if there was no, you know, federal government doing much of anything, so if you died, and you had a wife and some kids, like, they were out of luck. And so Father Michael organized the Knights of Columbus to take care of widows and orphans, which is about as biblical a charge as you can be, so that they wouldn't be taken away from the mother and families wouldn't be broken up and things like that. And so, you know, I think we forget this part of the story, because today to be an Irish American is just like anything else. But back then it was a really hard, really hard time. And, you know, this British Empire that conquered the world and had Virginia planters lording it over, you know, black people and pushing American Indians out west, they started by invading Ireland first. And the whole British Empire started in Ireland. And thank goodness that we have this wonderful republic. And thank you for the British Empire as well, that, you know, people have individual rights and they have dignity and they have all these things. But it took a long time, and it took a long time to get from that to where we have today, where everybody, no matter where what you look like or where you come from, you're an American. This is a time that's hard to imagine, I think, for the 21st century person saying, what's the big deal? What are you talking about? And I don't know if we know much about it. Like, you could look at that movie, Gangs of New York, maybe, or Far and Away, and you kind of get a glimpse of it. But he was doing a tremendous thing, Father McGivney, and likewise the Knights of Columbus. I'm not much aware of the Knights of Columbus. I found out a lot more about it reading about it this weekend while I was thinking about you and your book. So you're a knight. What do the knights do today? How many are there?
I believe internationally we're pushing 2 million Knights of Columbus members. Knights of Columbus is built on the pillars of charity, unity, fraternity, and patriotism. And the Knights is involved in, you know, at the council level, you know, it's the whole organization is made up of local councils who run independently. It is not run by the Knights of Columbus. It is not run by the church. It serves the church, but it is completely separated. And that was by Father McGivney's intentional design. And, you know, the different types of charity that the organization does, both at the local level and internationally, you know, things like the Special Olympics, things like local shelters for unwed mothers, pregnancy centers where women that are trying to make a decision on whether to keep their child or not can go in and get an ultrasound and get, you know, access to resources and so on. Another very recent international example is when Russia invaded Ukraine, the Knights of Columbus had existing Knights of Columbus councils in Poland, where they set up refugee centers. They had boots on the ground right there already. And, you know, Knights of Columbus said headquarters started sending, you know, millions of dollars worth of relief supplies and efforts. And again, they because they had Knights of Columbus members right on the ground at the border, they were there before the Red Cross was there. So it's, yeah, the organization is really to this day, carrying on Father Michael's legacy of caring for the needy and the outcast and the poor.
That's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful thing. Well, I appreciate that it's almost 6 o'clock. You're 9 o'clock, and I got to wake up some kids here and take them over to school. What have we forgotten to talk about? What else should we say that I?
No, I think really, I just want to end with why we wrote this book. It was kind of threefold. Number one was to raise awareness for the cause of canonization for Blessed Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Since he was beatified, there have been a number of miracles, my own included, that have been documented by the Knights. Father Michael has proven to be a pretty powerful intercessor. So we encourage people not only to pray for his canonization, pray for a miracle, pray for his intercession. And, if you go to fathermcgivney.org, you can find all kinds of information about the cause for canonization. And the other reason we wrote the book was really to, for those individuals and their families that are struggling from the scourge of alcoholism or addiction, by reading what happened to us, we hope that they will find hope and strength and courage to reach out and get help. And then lastly, like you mentioned, alluded to earlier, miracles are not just things we read about that happened centuries ago. They're happening every day.
Mm-hmm.
And even for the most devout, well, by hearing this beautiful story of God's grace and mercy, it'll maybe bring them one step closer on their journey.
Yeah, amen. My first child was supposed to have all kinds of problems before she was born. She had a chromosomal trisomy, and a lot of people were praying for her, and she turned out just fine. And it was like a 5% chance. And I remember the doctor who was, the best doctor in Boston on this one thing at the Brigham and Women's Hospital is saying, like, most people just start over, meaning you should abort this child. And, and it's not going to work. And a lot of people in our families were praying and praying and praying. And now we had this miracle child. And I know that another person in the next room might have the same situation. It turned out different. But I only have my own experience to talk about. And you only have your experience to talk about. So I hope that your very powerful message and this wonderful book reaches as many listeners as we have. There's always a few thousand people around the world who download this. And the book is called You're a Miracle. It's written by Joe McGivney. And if you go to fathermichaelmcgivney.org, you'll see the short movie called The American Blessed. It's less than half an hour long. It's a really beautiful film about Father Michael and the foundation of the Knights of Columbus. So I want to thank you so much for writing it and sharing it, because you have to say a lot of things that you would consider. Some people say, like, "Wow, I'm ashamed of these things," but you're like, "No, this is the work of God. This is, I'm a sinner, and guess what? I'm a sinner too, and so is every single listener to our show today." So thank you, Joe. And would you like to close us in a prayer?
I would. Thank you very much, Chris. If it's okay, I'm going to read the prayer for canonization of Blessed Michael McGivney. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. God, our Father, protector of the poor and defender of the widow and orphan, you called your priest, Blessed Michael McGivney, to be an apostle of Christian family life and to lead the young to the generous service of their neighbor. Through the example of his life and virtue, may we follow your Son, Jesus Christ, more closely, fulfilling his commandment of charity and building up his body, which is the church. Let the inspiration of your servant prompt us to greater confidence in your love, so that we may continue his work of caring for the needy and the outcast. We humbly ask that you glorify Blessed Michael McGivney on earth according to the design of your holy will. Through his intercession, grant the favor I now present. Through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Blessed Michael McGivney, pray for us.
Nails, spear shall pierce him through the cross. Jesus be born for me, for you, and hail, hail the Word made flesh, the babe, the Son of Mary.
Chris Odinets and Joe McGivney recorded this conversation, episode 80, on Monday, January 22nd, 2024. It's the feast day of St. Vincent of Saragossa, a 4th century Spanish martyr under Roman Emperor Diocletian. This episode will be published on February 29th, Leap Day, also the feast day of 5th century St. John Cassian, the erudite mystic who helped spread monastic tradition in the West. Our music is from Josh and Margot of the Great Space Coaster Band. Find their music at www.gscoasterband.com. And our logo, the image of the dog, is from the Monastery of Santo Domingo de Silos in Spain and is taken with the permission of the Dominican Friars of England, Scotland, and Wales from their website, www.english.op.org. I'm Chris Odinets. Thanks for listening. Send me an email to almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. I'd love to read it. And may God bless you and your family. Talk to you next time. And enjoy our blessed Lent.
This is Christ the King, whom shepherds, God, and angels sing.